So we mentioned last week that the data migration stuff was done, meaning basically that stuff, new data was going to Rumpus instead of BSketchID. Thought I had it all working yesterday. Discovered this morning that I'd been batch migrating the same 50 people's accounts every minute for 24 hours.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 268 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I'm saturated.
I'm Sam and I'm Eckhart.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is July 16th, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show. So I suppose children shouldn't be listening, but they will.
According to their parents, we think children should be listening.
Get educated. Podcast.
They're so slippery. You can't control them.
Seth, that's fish. Listen. Seth, that's fish that are slippery.
I often get fish and children.
Yeah, we don't have kids, so it's all very confusing.
Well, they both go to school. No.
Actually, no, they don't.
They should anyway. I actually wanted to laugh on that one, but I felt like it would be better if I just was silent. So I just held it in.
You guys stealing my dramatic effect for yourselves.
Yes. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bsketch.net. We grabbed your money. Thanks for letting us do that. Let's talk about life. I want to talk about squats. Namely, I can do them now. We got a squat rack.
That's amazing.
So I've been developing quarantine bod.
Is that the like Uncle Iroh in the jail in Avatar getting jacked in prison sort of bod? Or is this like the turning into a gelatinous blob bod?
This is Uncle Iroh before he went to prison.
Oh, gotcha.
When he was running a tea shop, kind of that phase.
So you're getting tea shop bod.
Yeah. Because most of my exercise revolved around weightlifting. And of course, without weights, weightlifting becomes more challenging.
It does.
And so I've been doing what I would call less of it. In that I've done none of it for 2 months. I've basically just been at the computer for 2 months.
Have you been doing anything? Like any exercise at all?
I did at first, but my exercise passion is lifting. And right. I just couldn't muster up the consistency to like just at the end of every workday just go do 100 squats with no weight on my back.
I will say
it's just so boring.
Yeah, it's far less interesting because the challenge actually only comes after you've been bored for a long time. And then you're like, now I can't feel my legs and I have to do 10 more of these. That's very exciting.
Yeah. I was like, I wanted to work my body, not my mind. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I feel that.
I don't need to power through the psychological barriers of like doing 85 push-ups before I get to the 5 that burn, you know?
Your lobes are strong enough, you know? You need your glutes to be strong. So, your lobes.
So one of those things, so we've been sort of slowly assembling essentially a CrossFit gym in our house. We got a box jump box last week, which it's a box that's it has three different heights depending on how you orient it. It's going to be 18 inches, 20 inches, or 24 inches.
I will for some reason when you told me that about the boxes, I became very preoccupied in my mind trying to figure out how that's possible. Any way you turn it, it's a different size. And I was like, but how? How could you have a box where it's what? And I've seen them, so I know they're real, but I can't
see boxes. Sam's seen boxes before.
I've seen boxes in the wild. But how?
You know how what? You know, sometimes boxes are not as tall as they are wide.
Or as tall as they are wide, narrow.
Or narrow. Right. That's the problem.
So we got that, but then the last piece to kind of bring the whole thing together was an actual rack to put a barbell in. And so now I can do pull-ups on this thing. I can do squats. So I've been lifting this week. I feel great.
Amazing.
My whole body hurts. It's so now I'm finally going to shed my quarantine cocoon. Mm-hmm. My body's been liquefied, and now I'm going to emerge
as a beautiful butterfly.
Eagle man.
A beautiful, muscly butterfly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that at the beginning of the pandemic, I was kind of like, yeah, like I'm not commuting anymore. I got all this time. I'm going to really take the reins of my physique, you know. But it really is just the case that some things are just more enjoyable than others.
And yeah.
Doing 100 squats is not that great.
Find what you love, you know. I was running for a good while. Still am, but I don't mind banging out a bunch of push-ups and stuff, but I do miss lifting. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's that work smart, not hard, right? Like push a thing up 6 times instead of 60 90. Times.
Yep.
Yeah. But you've also been eating scones, as I understand.
Well, so yeah, you had this update on the docket, and I was like, I need to balance this out for anyone else.
As in, are you balancing out health for something that's not healthy, or
yes,
he's okay. Bringing balance to the force.
Yeah, I'm thinking about our collective health as a unit, and since that's apparently improving his, it's gotta go down somewhere.
I'm pretty sure I'm covering the downside. Pretty.
So Diane and I, the shop sort of around the corner from us, called Winslow's Table, has a bakery window that they opened up. Okay. So you just walk up, they got hand sanitizer, they like rub everything down, you wear a mask the whole time. There's hardly anyone there ever in line. And so every couple of days we walk by, get a scone. And these scones, good Lord, they are so good. It is insane. And so we've just been eating a tremendous number of scones over the last couple of weeks, and I'm very into it. I don't feel bad about it
now, at all. Here's the thing that I know about scones is I read – you remember the Redwall Abbey books?
That's the thing. I think that's why I was into them, yeah.
They would always talk about scones. And
every time.
That book – and this is a vivid memory from my youth – that book would talk about scones all the time as if I was supposed to just know what a scone was, and I didn't.
Yeah,
and
I think I don't remember when the first time I encountered a scone was, but my wife makes them pretty – with some frequency now, and I think it may be that the first time I actually had a scone and knew that I was doing that was one that she made.
That's totally possible.
As an adult human, you know?
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I'm 30. How old am I?
You're 30.
I'm 33, and I still actually don't know what a scone is. Like I couldn't pick one out of a police.
I don't know how you would define it exactly.
I would define it as a muffin that is triangle shaped.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Triangle muffin.
Does it have to be triangle shaped?
Yes.
Can
yes.
you have a
that is the only requirement? It can be made out of anything. Doesn't matter. Just got to be shaped like a triangle.
Because I'm pretty confident that I've had scones before. And I also remember being a little bit disappointed because the Redwall books talked about scones so much that I thought these things must be just
– yeah.
And they must be incredible because growing up, I'd never seen one. I never had one.
Well, especially in the context
of – it was almost like a mythological food.
Yeah, in the context of Redwall, like all this – that whole series, which is just this fantastical adventures of these weird – well, frankly, animals that are people, basically. I get that. If you're like, these are real things, and then you go have one and it's a triangle shaped muffin, and you're like,
it's just a muffin.
Okay. I think something we didn't appreciate about the Redwall series was that as sort of, animals without a spice trade, their palates were actually quite limited. And they may not even have had salt,
That's why honey was such a big deal. Remember?
Honey was a huge deal. And if you're talking
about
scone,
honey all the time.
Yeah, like every piece of food actually basically tastes the same as every other one if you can't put salt and spice on it, right? So probably to them, scones were just as good as anything, and maybe even a little bit better because you get some sweetness in there, or something else. Or who knows? Maybe there are meat scones. I don't know. I don't know what you can put in a scone.
That's the thing. That's that author, Brian Jacques, I have no idea how to say his name after all this time. His metaverse, like this, the world he created, so deep with its spice trade roots not passing anywhere near Redwall or that entire territory. He had that mapped out. So I think it's kudos. kudos to him.
Yes. It's almost like he orchestrated this entire universe such that he could spend a lot of time writing about scones.
Frankly, that, reading it through that lens, yeah, you could see that 100%.
Because he's like, I can't just write a fantasy book that's just about scones because they just don't have enough character arcs and conflicts
right.
going
and
on.
And if I write it about people, then people know that scones are like only okay on average, right? So
they're just fine.
So yeah. I need to have some sort of characters that don't know that scones are only medium. So I need to create a universe that's not filled with people and that doesn't have a spice trait.
I need to create a universe in which scones are the best thing. I need to cut out – he's like, I love scones. Scones, to me, scones are the best, but nobody else agrees with me on this. So I need to create a universe in which scones are the top food, period.
It's sort of conspiracy theory that I've always wanted, you know? Like, well, how come we don't get these conspiracy theories? That like the Redwall books are really just a man who wants to
– scone propaganda.
sell more baked goods for his local bake shop.
Yeah, next we're going to find out that he's got like a cousin who runs a scone shop or some shit.
Boom.
And just this whole thing. How deep does this go?
Scone gate goes all the way to the top. the deep scone gate, you know?
Scone gate. Yeah, Big Scone is pumping money into the Redwall books to prop him up.
The thing with Big Scone, though, industry. Is because it's triangle shaped. It's pretty easy to spot. It's pretty easy to pick out from the crowd of all the other big pharma, big all. You know, everyone else is in a box shape, but Big Scone,
yep.
You know them. Come for you, yep. The triangle. Maybe Illuminati's involved.
Big Scone. You know? That's why it's a triangle.
Yep.
It's probably.
You're exactly don't look, right. Don't, holy
don't
shit.
Don't look too deep. Don't look too deep at that scone. It'll look right back.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we also need to talk about – there was a fucking huge storm yesterday.
It was wild.
It was great.
We were in the middle of a design chat actually about some Crash and Stew pre-production stuff. And very good discussion, just burning through interesting stuff, answering questions left and right. Very good. And then storm rolls in and it's Seth had reported it because he's a bit further out west than we are. And so – he's like, oh man, there's
yeah. It goes like Seth, then 5 miles Sam, then 5 miles me, basically. Mm-hmm. So we can hear it on each other's like microphones rolling through.
Yeah, and that was pretty wild because before it even got here, we heard it crackling through Seth, and then it was like a sheet just outside. It was just completely rain.
It only lasted like 15 minutes.
Well, it hit me, and then I suddenly interrupted the design chat. I was like, by the way, guys, not to interrupt, but save whatever you have, commit and push. Because something's gonna happen,
which was a good thing. Because basically, what happened was about I think we still had like 20 minutes left, like 4:42, I believe, is the exact time. Power, boom, gone in my house. And the thing is, like, usually during a storm, if you get one of those, it's like a flicker, right? So your machine might power down, everything comes back. And so I was in this sort of weird state for like a few minutes afterwards, where I was like, "Is this?" Like for real this time? Or is this a flicker? Like a really long flicker. Like the longest flicker that there has ever been. And then after about 10 minutes, I came downstairs. And my wife, of course, who was – she was working on stuff in the basement. So she's – I think she was in the garage where the power went out. And so
– oh, no.
Just pitch black. And so
– no windows.
Yeah. So she couldn't even work on her stuff anymore. And so both of us just kind of moseying around for like an hour or so. Couldn't figure out what to do. And then like my cell service was actually – turns out I don't think it's actually very good in my house. But I'm always on Wi-Fi. So it's never mattered. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, of course, that's the only thing.
It mattered.
And also you can't go anywhere because of COVID. So it's not like I could be like, I'm going to go to a coffee shop and finish up work or do whatever I was going to do. And so it was this weird – it was honestly a weird situation where I was suddenly realized sort of a startle just how dependent on power people are generally, but especially during a damn pandemic when like
yep.
you can't go, you're supposed to go anywhere. So like,
how are you self entertaining and keeping busy in your house? Everything is power.
Yeah.
Everything's electricity.
And because I didn't pre-plan for it, you know, for the power going out, that I didn't have any, like I have a Kindle, I have some stuff that I could, you know, that has book. I've just had books on my shelf, but I've read all those ones. And then I just came off vacation, so I also just read all the books that are in my Kindle. So I like dug through it until I hit stuff that I pulled up maybe like a year ago, maybe didn't finish or whatever else, and just I kind of started reading, but I didn't really want to. I didn't come here for this. I was just having to do something to entertain my brain. So it was a weird, weird sort of evening.
Okay, I have an idea. I have a cool idea. Take a duffel bag or some kind of a container. Okay, create yourself a power outage evening entertainment kit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Put some wine in there, because that's never going to go bad, right? It'll True. Only get better. Put some wine in there, red wine, because it doesn't have to be refrigerated. Then put some books, get some, I don't know, just some board games. There's like 2-person board games. And then when the power goes out, you can be like, oh, yes.
It's time.
And then you can go, because then you can bust out your power outage.
I feel like with that sort of a vibe, you should actually gift wrap it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because like, talk about starting it off right. You just go tear into that thing. Oh, that'd be so fun. You're ridiculous.
And then when a storm comes, you're like, oh, is it time? Is it going to happen?
you can get a cool like little lantern in there and maybe like a Lego kit.
Well, that's actually all we had. Yeah, all we had for light was this little weird lantern that I got in Diana a long time ago for I think actually before we were going to go camping and they never did. We bought this little super-powered little lantern that you hand crank.
I got one of those. Yeah. It's good to have one of those because they cast light like crazy.
They do, but that's the thing. Like, it's a very particular kind because it's coming at you from the side, like not from above. So actually, as soon as it's dark, it's actually very hard to use it to do basically anything with, because if you set it on the table, it just blinds you. That's it.
Yep.
And I was like, this is not the best. So it was a hot sleep last night without AC, but we're getting along okay.
Yep. So I think I may have to look more into this power outage party kit because it sounds pretty dope. Then Adam, you got a cat.
Yeah, right, it's happened.
The storm hit.
The night before, but yeah, so right 24 hours before the storm hit.
Yeah.
We found a kitten. I can't remember. I think last week when we were talking about stuff, I had mentioned that we found the one we were going to get.
Yes.
I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yes, we picked her up on Monday night after work or Tuesday night and brought her home. And she is so fucking tiny. Like, so she's a 4-month-old kitten. And I haven't had like a kitten since we were kids, probably. And those were the ones that we just like found out in the ditch or something, right? Because we lived in the country and people would just throw animals out the window because they're a bunch of assholes. So I haven't just had like a kitten. And the one that we got a few months ago, Ori, was 6 months old when we got him. And the difference between a 4-month-old and a 6-month-old kitten is fucking hilarious. They're like, there's literally
50%.
I think it's a twofold difference. Like it's,
oh man,
it's crazy. Her head's like the size of a ping pong ball. It's like, if you were to take 2 ping pong balls and kind of like mush them together, that's like the size of her little tiny head. So she's so small. And then she has this giant belly incision because they spayed her right before we got her, like 5 days before we got her. And so she's this like little tiny thing with this giant incision down her belly. And so like every time I pick her up, I'm like, oh my God, what if I break this? You know, like she's just so, you know, my other cats are just like flinging around and like, you know, making them dance and doing all the stuff that you do with cats, right? Mm-hmm. With tolerant cats. And they don't give a shit about what's happening because cats are very robust. They're noodles. And I'm pretty sure this cat doesn't either because she's like leaping on things and doing all the kind of stuff that cats do. But every time I pick her up, I'm just like, it's terrifying because she's too
small.
She's too little. It doesn't even make sense. I don't even know where she puts her little guts, you know?
She's also got those hypodermic needle talons. So that's the
We didn't manage to cut those off because once she goes to sleep, she's really fucking asleep. But she, outside of that, she's very squirrely and hard to control. So we're trying it. We're trying this whole, lady eating the fly scenario. Problem. Yep.
Yeah.
So far the 2 kittens seem to be interested in each other's presence, but we're doing the whole, you know, slow. With cats, you do the slow introduction, like a very slow introduction over a week or two where, you know, you have one in one room, you let the other one come sniff under the door, you give them both treats while this is happening, you like rub one with something and then rub it on the other one to get the scents all mixed up, you know? And, so this is just slow as fuck process that we tried to skip and make shorter with our last kitten that we got. And that was a mistake, man. So this time we're going to take it.
It's the DevOps of cat rearing, you know?
Small batch cat introduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just take it one step at a time. So I don't know. She's very, very cute. Very exciting. I haven't gotten to spend any time with her because she just has to be in one room so the other cats can't so they can't form any negative, interactions early on. And so she's just with my wife in her office. And so for my lunch break, I go for 5 minutes and rub her tiny head, And then after work, there's a lot of kitten tossing time, but
amazing.
Well, good luck. I'm curious to hear on the next episode, if it works.
Yeah, because by the next episode, we will have probably introduced the two kittens to each other. So hopefully.
What's going to happen is they're going to lock eyes and they're going to be like, yes. And then they're both going to turn and immediately start harassing the third cat.
That's kind of what I figure is going to be. My main worry, because she's just so small, because she's got at least as much energy as our other kitten does. But she's tiny. And the other kitten, the problem that we have with him is he's a very aggressive player. And so now I'm like, even if they both do want to play with each other, he's going to kill her on accident, He's going to gently tap her little face and her head will come flying off across the room. Sort of a scenario. So
nah, kittens are robust. And animals usually have a pretty good sense.
It is around. Funny too, because again, she just had her guts ripped out a few days ago, basically, right? And this incision is as long as her fucking belly, right? So it's a third of her body length. And it looks really grody because she's just looking at it constantly, right? And she just doesn't give a fuck. She's just running around, leaping on things and just doing the high energy stuff, leaping onto a counter. She's about maybe whatever tall this is, she's about 6 inches tall, probably something like that. And she's leaping onto counters that are 4 feet high, right? All with this fresh belly wound where
it's like training with ankle weights, She's just getting ready.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can't imagine how she's going to be. She's going to be a fucking maniac when she gets healed up in the group. I was thinking back to when I had my gut surgery a few years ago now, and just how fucking incapacitated I was for week. I mean, it was a week of pure incapacitation where I couldn't sit up because I had holes punched through my abs, right? But my abs were intact. They just had some holes in them, right? But that was enough that my body didn't want to lift up because it just hurt so much. And then my body was just like, no, I'm not going to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I had to prop myself up and never be fully prone because I couldn't get back up, all this stuff. And it just hurt so bad for 2 weeks. And then there's this little kitten who's just like, yeah, I had my guts removed. I don't give a fuck. It's fine.
I'm jumping on cat.
Well, when your cat turns 30 and then has a gut surgery, we'll see.
That's also
we'll
true.
See how well she responds. That's true.
Because I guess if I had been a – because if you do surgery on babies, they recover basically instantly.
Instantly. They don't care. They have no idea what's going on. All right. Let's talk about some studio news. For starters, we now have Rumpus fully integrated into Crashlands. So we are now in vigorous testing mode, and it's still going to be quite some time before we deploy this thing because we're going to be probably rolling out just all of the games,
just all in
a wave, which is actually what we did with Beescotch ID back in the day because we originally had Quadrupus Rampage, Flop Rocket, Road Rage and Tile Fight. All four of them were built before we had Beescotch ID. Then we made Beescotch ID, and then we sort of re-released those games as 2.0 versions.
Did we do it all at the same time, or did we do it in some stack?
Yeah, we did them all at the same time, which was cool. And that actually gave us a big featuring opportunity on iOS, which was cool. Mm-hmm. And that was our first launch onto iOS for a couple of those games. So we're going to be kind of doing that big wave again, and it's been super fun. It's also kind of interesting to see it's cool to see the sort of reusable solutions thing that happens in programming, where Crashlands took 3 weeks to get everything sort of shored up. And I'm now only about 4 hours into Roid Rage, and it's about half done. Mm-hmm. And
most of that will also roll forward.
Yeah, and the reason it's going to take more than that is because there's a couple of new problems to solve. But then once those are solved, I just drop them into Flop Rocket and Quadrupus, right? And so it's really accelerating, And we're also doing some fun stuff like just kind of sharpening up some things in those games, increasing their resolution a little bit. You know, they're just going to feel and look nicer.
So or at least lots of good stuff. Broken on certain devices now.
Yeah. So on some devices, Beastcatch ID just crashes. I think when you try to log in, it just crashes.
It's like, no.
Yep. Well, and we, because we were just talking about this today too, we long ago had made the assumption that there was sort of a max, what do you call it?
Skinniness.
Width versus height ratio, right? That devices would have. I think we called it 2-to-1 or something like that, because it was the widest device at the time. Actually, it was wider than the widest device at the time, but we were like, surely nobody would go beyond 2x1. And we are well past 2x1 as the max at this point. And so there are even the devices that we have, like each one of us, I'm pretty sure has a more than 2x1 device. And that kind of fucks with some of the games a bit, turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're all just going to look better, be smoother. You're going to have rumpus in them. Oh. That's going to be so good.
It is funny though, because I remember back when we were talking about all this resolution stuff, the thing that we were so worried about actually was PC gamers, like with crashes in particular, and being like, they're wily. They have like every kind of monitor imaginable. They got like 10 in a row, and like maybe they have them in a diagonal pattern. Like, who knows what those squirrely PC players are doing, right? And so that's the thing we were obsessed about, like trying to make sure we covered the cases so that we had things that just at least behaved well, if not the way that the user necessarily expected. But then it turned out really all in the end, it was actually mobile that's giving us the most headaches.
It's always the ones you least suspect that will betray you.
Yes.
You know, that's the lesson.
So
that's coming along well. I presume that by the time we record the next episode, we'll probably be done with Roid Rage, be testing that, might even be done with Flop Rocket. So things are just cruising. And by the time we get done with all the games, then it's time.
Mm-hmm. Time for the next game. Yeah, for a thing. It has been the data migration stuff has been quite nightmarish. We've talked about it a little bit, but things keep on cropping up. So we mentioned last week that the data migration stuff was done, meaning basically that stuff, new data was going to Rumpus instead of Beastcatch ID. But all the old data was still there and needed to be ported over. And so that's what I've been working on is sort of batch operations of all that stuff. Thought I had it all working yesterday. Discovered this morning that I'd been batch migrating the same 50 people's accounts every minute for 24 hours. So figured that one out. It's always something stupid. So I took an hour to figure out, of course, even though it was something stupid. So we had that happen. Also discovered yesterday that the in-app purchases for all the games that have those, that those are also editing the same data that like the game is using to store stuff. And I just kind of forgot about in-app purchases. And so those weren't being migrated. So then for those users who had migration happen, their migrated data now is completely separate from their in-app purchases. So if you made a purchase, like in the 5-day window during which this was true, it showed up in Beastcatch ID, but not in Rumpus where it needed to be. And so then it was as if you didn't make a purchase. Hmm. So then that happened, I had to deal with that. And then today discovered that users are trying to still gift Butter Ups because there's like, what, one user every like 4 weeks or something that wants to try to use the Butter Up gifting process that we have. And this follows the same. This is yet another like completely separate independent avenue into this data that I also had forgotten about. And so I haven't figured this one out yet because it turns out it's pretty convoluted. But yeah, these fucking things just keep – like I thought I had it. I thought I had everything rolling. I was like, I could just batch this thing and be done with it. And just these little fucking things keep on coming.
Beastcatcher indeed. I mean, it did a lot of things.
We are throwing almost all of it away, like almost all the stuff that it does. And it's still
– replacing almost all of it.
Well, even like the friend system and messaging and all that stuff is going to be gone.
Yeah. Yeah, we set it up to do all these things, but because we don't have a dev environment, we can't test things in it, which means we set it up to do all these things, but we couldn't really use those things very effectively just because they were too hard to hook up to the games. Mm-hmm. So yep. Going forward, it's going to be great. We're gonna be able to much more easily modify things. So we'll have some more info on sort of when these rollouts will actually start to happen, probably within a few weeks, but we'll have some updates. All right, let's get on to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Heist upvoted question comes from Tofos, who says, some time has passed since you've launched Levelhead. 100 years probably, since that's how long you have to wait to get 10 upvotes on your question.
Sounds about right.
So, how is Levelhead doing compared to Crashlands?
I think we've already kind of talked about this a little bit.
Well, I mean, we have way more players coming in because it's just in more places. Yes, definitely.
Way more.
And it's
Levelhead players you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially through things like Xbox Game Pass, which Crashlands is not in. Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely still way more active in terms of like player activity, Discord, all that kind of stuff. But because we did the free Epic thing with Crashlands, like at the same time as we launched Levelhead, we got this just huge influx of Crashlands players, a couple million actually. And of course, like since they were free players, then almost all of them never even got past the main menu.
Well, probably most of them didn't install the game.
Most people don't boot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how free games work.
I mean, that has been my own experience with free games with Epic. I think my Epic library now has at least 50 games in it, and I've installed, I think, three of them.
But it still is the case that actually Crashlands is getting a pretty good surge. The big problem is we have no good means of tracking stuff because Crashlands uses Bscotch ID, which isn't hooked into our normal analytics system.
So actually, can't really say.
So we can't say. We will be able to say once we get the Rumpus update out for Crashlands.
Yeah. I say it's also good timing because we have the we'll have the Levelhead update out actually not too long. We haven't 100% finalized the date yet, but we have a date that we're making sure is all good, and it's actually not too far away. And so that's super exciting. I think the changes we're making are basically designed as far as beyond just adding a ton of cool stuff to the update, are also designed to basically help keep players around if they're coming from one of these essentially lower investment services. So if you're coming from a subscription model, make it so the tutorial is just a bit like basically a thing that you can dodge if you want to and that sort of thing, because people who are not invested don't want to sit around and wait for you to finish explaining how the game works, right? So I think we had a couple of other changes to it that I'm really looking forward to, and I'm stoked to see the overall creation potential from all the new stuff. I will say the general pace of levels coming in is still ridiculous. Like the total amount of content is just obscene. And
we are now at 75,000 levels.
I was going to not say that so we could say that for the update, but yeah, sure.
Okay. I didn't know this was a secret.
It's not a secret, but I mean, it's like ridiculous. Just the total number of creations that people put in, especially when you imagine that each one of the levels, typically, it's a couple hours of input for people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're still getting, it seemed like actually just last week, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but it seemed like just this last week or two, I feel like I've heard from like five or six people. They're like, oh yeah, my kid's been playing Levelhead, just loves it. Just been playing the shit out of it all the time.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the nice things about making, about making games or making anything that like, that can just kind of passively do stuff.
Exist.
Yeah. Cause it just kind of keeps on, keep it on in a really cool way. So it's been fun to see.
Yep. So we don't really know the comparison. We'll find out though. We'll find out how Crashlands is doing compared to Levelhead.
In terms of just number of users, it is the case that we have basically twice as many users that came in via Crashlands as we do that came in via Levelhead. But that's with a 4-year head start in the case of Crashlands.
Yeah. Yes. And lots of bundles.
And lots of bundles and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then, of course, also that free Epic thing and all that stuff. So So given that, I think Levelhead is comparable, but it's not blowing Crashlands out of the water or anything like that.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from Captain Wiggly, who says, as an indie studio, what strategies have you found to be the least effective for promoting your games? And do you ever think a publisher would have been worth it for a launch like Levelhead? Mm-hmm. So least effective strategies for promoting your game.
Pretty much all of them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too. What are you
going to say? Yeah, any one strategy on its own is essentially useless. Mm-hmm. Kind of no matter what it is. It's really just the aggregate with a few exceptions of things that I would advocate for being completely useless on their own. And I think for me that's conventions. So the reason a convention is useful is if you've already done the work to set up a bunch of meetings to meet with press or whatever, but it's kind of questionable as to whether or not you would need to demo and get a booth
at
and
a do all these other things specifically.
A convention specifically to make that happen.
Or if you're doing it because there are, you know, awards tied to certain kinds of convention things. Because then once you get those award leaves and you can use that for social proof that the thing you've made is something that people want, and then you can roll that forward into future success and so on.
Yeah, because I mean if you're talking about, say, like dropping $10,000 to which is a pretty good guess if you're gonna like go to Seattle for a weekend, spend a week or two setting up some kind of special demo version of your game.
Don't ignore tickets. The dev cost of preparing a demo.
Get plane tickets, get hotels, go there, come back, get sick, take a week off and recover, et cetera, et cetera. It's super expensive. And if you were to just say, you know what, I'm just going to keep working on my game as normal, and instead I'm going to drop $5,000 on a YouTube ad to promote my trailer or something. All of a sudden you're going to get like how many views do you get on a YouTube video for like $5,000?
I mean, the Levelhead one, it's far above $5,000, but as far as like the general conversion, it would be somewhere between like 250
thousand.
Yeah.
250 yeah. What to what? What's the conversion to?
So it's troublesome. The 5K to what K views? I think it was something around. It's anywhere between 100 and I think it's between 100 and 250,000 or so.
Yeah. So the thing is, like, and when it comes to things like YouTube ads, you're only paying for people who actually watch through the thing, right? There's like a certain threshold where you pay. And so if somebody just like opens up your ad and then immediately closes it or hits skip or whatever, then you're not getting charged for that. So for like half the cost of going to PAX, you could have more people who attend more people than even attended PAX see your trailer, right? It's definitely a different context.
Right. Yeah. But I think the most important thing is that you can't the problem is that you can't do deals with YouTube ads, right? Which is actually where the conventions come in. But I think that's sort of the greater point that I think Seth, you were getting at, and same thing with Adam, which is that each one of these things, they're all kind of mutually dependent on each other. And anytime you're doing activity in one of them, oftentimes it feels like you can't even. You're like, what the hell? This is like my 40th tweet. This, like the last 2 weeks, part of this, I'm doing a contest. I don't know what's happening. Are you emailing people or whatever else? There's just a lot of stuff that oftentimes happens before you end up having that one thing happen that ends up being super useful. And I think that's part of the trouble with wrapping your head around it, you know?
Is that everything you did was pointless. On its own.
Well, also none of it is measurable. So even those YouTube ads we did, we have no idea if that was worth doing. There's literally no way for us to know. We do know that to the best of our ability to actually measure stuff, which is very, very hard for measuring the results of ads. But our best reasonable guess is that it cost us more to advertise than we earned directly from advertising, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also not necessarily the point of advertising when you launch a game, because most of the point advertising launching a game is to build brand awareness so that when people see it in the context of which they will buy it, so they boot up Xbox and you know shows up on the front page, they're scrolling through the list on Switch and they see your box art or whatever, right? That they've seen it before, so it looks familiar. They may not remember why, but it looks familiar, so they take an extra half of a second to like look at that thing, which then increases the likelihood they actually go look into it and eventually buy it. And so because this is how
Coca-Cola works.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody can forget that Coca-Cola exists, right?
Yeah. It's called the mere exposure effect, which is it's a common marketing approach, which is to just saturate people's awareness with your product so that when a purchase opportunity finally does arise, then your product is just more familiar.
Yeah. Right? But this is very
more likely to get it.
This is a super expensive strategy. If this is the only thing available to you to make people aware of your thing is advertising, it's probably not going to be cost effective, probably, because you're basically using advertising as a way to sort of like claw and hook into other things that can also boost visibility in different ways. So I think our thinking on this has varied a lot over the years, to thinking that certain things are completely useless, to everything is useless, to certain things are really important, to really think finally boiling down to for the same reason that we launch on multiple platforms. Like we don't launch just on one platform because you never know how well a single platform is going to perform. And if we look right now at what our tail looks like for Levelhead, the reason that Levelhead is going to allow us to continue making games in terms of like the money that's being made on the daily, right, is because it's on a bunch of platforms.
Yep.
Any one platform alone, we would not be making enough money to continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah. I think that was even true with Crashlands.
It was true. Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like frankly, this should always be the case. Because like if a game is successful enough by itself on just one platform, that typically is where you just – that's literally what a hit is, right, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Which is like if you've made something that like it's going. But that's not necessarily a thing you can depend on. And I think you're right that it's
similar. And it would have been far more successful if it was a hit, if it was also a hit on every other platform.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 So I think it's much smarter to approach it strategically from the angle of saying, okay, so what do we have the capacity to effectively deliver on? What are we good at? What's appropriate for the game? You know, does it make awesome GIFs or not? Is it good for YouTube or not?
Would a PR company be able to convince people IGN, in the press to actually cover it? And yeah, that sort of stuff.
And then go from there, I think is probably the approach. Because the truth is like you have limited time. So you still have to like, especially as a small team, you oftentimes do have to choose where the weight goes. But I think people, and I think we've done it in the past too, is we've done it more out of kind of whatever we were doing at the time, not necessarily based on what would be best for that particular game, which is the hard part to kind of wrap your head around, I think.
So I also want to talk a little bit about influencers. Mm-hmm. In that there's been a lot of talk about the importance of getting influencers to play your game, right? And that they will like bring their audience to the game and stuff like that. And in our case, it actually was the case that when Steve Gaming, when he made his YouTube video about Levelhead, we saw a spike that was actually larger than our initial early access launch.
Mm-hmm. And it also brought in some of the people who are still our most active community members.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's definitely the case that in some situations, influencers can bring an audience to a game.
But I think it only works if the influencer themselves and their community mesh really well with your game.
Yeah. Yes. And so there's an interesting sort of catch-22 with streamers, which is streamers are just as influenced as they are influencers. So they will tend to want to play games that already have audiences of people who are excited about that game. Because
why wouldn't they? Because they need viewers.
It's the same reason why you would see 15,000 articles about Fortnite be written every single day, despite there being no new information or news about Fortnite.
Right.
Or despite the news being very small, right?
The news being like somebody found some possible thing about some gun, but nobody really knows for sure yet. Like there, boom, there's an IGN article. and the reason is that that people who are content creators, like reviewers, YouTubers, streamers, whatever, they live and die by their audiences. They need a big audience, and audiences show up to see things that they're already interested in. So, so there's kind of an interesting push and pull when it comes to promoting your game through influencers, which is they really don't want to cover your game as a means of promoting it. They want to cover a game that's going to expand their audience, right? Like it's not their job to bring an audience to your game. It's your job to bring your game's audience to them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So a lot of times you'll see streamers doing like paid sponsorships and promotions and stuff like that. Those tend to be super expensive.
Like crazy expensive.
And it's very hard to figure out whether that actually
– It's because it's completely nuanced. It completely depends on that. Yeah. Like Adam said, the interaction between two entities, the actual person and the game – determines whether or not it'll actually end up being
and the kind of streamer that they are.
And ethically, if it's a good streamer operating, a business properly, then they would need to tell you this is sponsored content, right? And the moment that a thing is sponsored content,
a proportion of the audience gets skeptical.
Yeah, they're immediately skeptical because someone's being paid to do it. So it turns out it's actually just incredibly difficult to get anybody on any part of the process. The one thing you can reliably do is pay an advertising company to show ads to people. Like that you can make happen. But whether or not people give a shit when they see your ads, right, is yet another problem that you have to deal with. And so there's no way that just works. And it all depends on what it is that you're offering, what your competitors are doing, the influencers who are going to try to use – because they're trying to use your product to make themselves more successful, right? It all depends on the ability of your game to meet all the sides of the PR side of the market successfully.
So yeah, the thing that I remember the most about all this for some reason that sticks out is it's just like a weird example of just how nobody really has any good idea of what works and what doesn't work is when Blizzard was launching their Warlords of Draenor expansion. And they bought a taxi cab and made a giant replica of Gore Howl, which is the axe used by Grom Hellscream in the game. And they punched this axe into the taxi cab. So this axe was like 12 feet long. It was fucking huge. So it was as if somebody had just chopped this taxi. And then they rented a portion of Times Square and parked the cab there. And if you walked past that and you didn't already know about this axe or this game or whatever, it's just a cab with an axe in it.
Well, you would be definitely like, what the fuck?
Yeah, and you think that is crazy. And you might look it up later or whatever. And it was very eye-catching.
Lots of news articles and there was a whole bunch that came out of it. But there's still the question because without a doubt, that cost them a few $100,000, right, to stage that.
That's a pricey spot.
Very pricey. And would it have been better had they just done $100,000 of YouTube ads?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Nobody can say. And nobody can say, like, what was the conversion rate of people who walked past that axe in Times Square? Like, nobody knows. Nobody can say anything about it other than that it certainly got people talking. it was memorable.
Yep. Yeah, so, I think you've made it when you can spend advertising money on those sorts of what's the word for that? Stunts, yeah. We can spend money on stunts because you're basically saying – I'm so confident in our ability to sell this thing that I can just generate news about it with using money. Cause it's like, cause you can't do a stunt without either a fuckload of money or doing something really irresponsible or both your options. And so just to have that much resources, right. Where you could basically say like, it doesn't actually matter really if this $200,000 stunt doesn't result in anything like $200,000 of actual revenue because our only goal is just to be everywhere.
Cause a ruckus.
We're gonna pay out the nose to be everywhere because our budget – because I assume the budget for Blizzard to put one of these things out is in the tens of millions of dollars at least, right, for, for an update.
Well, and this is, of course, like Blizzard is a subsidiary of Activision, who owns King, which is the creators of Candy Crush.
Oh, I forgot about that.
We know that Candy Crush spends over $1 billion a year on ads. Like, what's 200,000? You know, in that pool, you can't even see it. It's just a speck.
I'm still waiting for a taxi cab being smashed by Candy Crush pieces, though. You know? That would get me confused.
A giant,
or just like full of taxi cab full of candy. Like the windows are open and it's just like falling out the sides.
I think lawyers would call that entrapment or something. No, what is it? It's an attractive nuisance.
Attractive nuisance, yeah. I don't think it was mean to trap it.
You'd lure people in to eat candy off the ground. All right, next question comes from Buckaroo Vimtangle, who says, I know you've talked – oh, sorry. I was hoping you could talk more around the headspace for taking game development seriously. I know you've talked about the power of game jams, but coming from an animation freelance background, I'm having trouble seeing the path from make games to what? Should I just double down on skills, find collaborators, get funds? I know I shouldn't set out with the objective of making money, but I also enjoy building systems around the game products. I'd love to have each of your take on how to put my game face on.
I think it depends on what you're trying to do. I think if you don't know where you're trying to go, then you can't actually answer all those questions, right? Because like give me an example. So if you're super competent at animation, there are types of games you can make that have a lot of animation to them, where that could basically be a thing you show off. And the question is, would you still have enough time to program the damn game? So are you wanting to do this as like a solo project, or is it something that you actually – is there some vision you want to bring to life that you would like to actually try pitching a publisher on or something like that? Usually what you would want in that case is you want to build enough of it, especially if you don't have a background in the industry, build enough of it that someone could sit down and play it and see it. And then if they can see parts of your animation reel or whatever else, that they could then say, yes, you know, we want to give you some cash monies and have you build this thing. You could take that route. So there's that sort of the investment route, which is, I think, probably the more of the traditional one than just the quit your job for 5 years, build it alone in a basement sort of approach. It's also a better idea because it's less risky for you overall if you can get someone else to pay for it, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and nobody's going to pay for an idea, right? Like,
yes.
You need to – if you're an animator and you don't think of yourself as a programmer, then if your goal is to go into this commercially, so like start up your own studio, start making your own IP and selling your games, mm-hmm. I would think that forming a studio and a team, like a founding team, would be kind of priority number one. But it's kind of a circular problem. I would say that can be hard to break through. I know that for me, I started making games just on my own, and I did that for a year and a half or so before I was making anything even remotely good enough to start to convince other people to come with me on the journey. Because nobody wants to hitch their wagon to a horse with no legs.
As the saying goes,
yep. You got to show that you can go places.
Yeah, that's just a seal at that point. You know,
that's just
a seal is just a horse with side legs.
So you got to demonstrate confidence and competence in your craft to get people to rally behind you. And if you're able to do that, then it's much easier to form a team.
But that's still assuming your next step is to form a team and make a company out of a group of people, because it doesn't have to be, right? It could still be the solo move. It could still be self-funded. It could still be a hobby. There's any approach.
No, I'm saying the path is the same in all cases, which is continue to make awesome things and develop your skills.
Sure, yeah, but that's not sufficient though, because if you're just getting better at it but don't have but don't figure out how you're going to try to start selling stuff or have an idea of like what scope means in relation to your goals, right? Because if you're going to sit down and the first thing you're going to make is your solo made MMO that you're going to spend 15 years making and then eventually launch and have that to come to nothing, right? Then that's, you know, that's not a good path. Even if that's the path you want to take, it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think Sam's point that you actually have to, that you have to decide what your goals actually are. Cause and I think you actually, there was a moment in that question that was about, I know I shouldn't do this to make money, right? Which is mm-hmm. not the right position to take, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to do it to live, you need to make money doing it.
Yeah. So you if you want to do it for a hobby, then yeah, you're absolutely right. You don't need to do it to make money. And then, but as soon as that's true, then the question of like, what's the next step and what, like all that goes away actually. Cause then you just do whatever you
then
want.
Then it's just whatever you find fun. Yeah. That's the whole reason you're going to begin
with. Yeah. If you want to do it as an actual business, then you have to treat it like a business. So actually, and we had a long conversation about this and an episode or two ago mm-hmm. yeah, about absolutely. The idea that actually the core point of going from being a hobbyist and kind of trying to figure out what's important and brushing up your skills and that sort of stuff to actually doing game making for a living is in treating this as a business and treating mm-hmm. it as a business first. And that's now a whole new set of skills you have to go start digging into. But that's what reveals to you the questions that you need to start asking, because once you're going to treat it like a business where your goal is to earn your keep, you know, making games, then that's where you can start. You start with that as your foundation and start asking questions about, okay, how can I make this possible? Right. Do I have the skill myself required to do every component of what it takes to do that? And if not, what are the pieces that are missing? So then you can go start filling in those gaps, but the whole time with an eye toward the goal of this thing being to run as a business.
I do think it's funny that I know, we talk a lot about doing stuff yourself or starting your own team or whatever else, but the truth too is that, especially if you already have a skill that would be useful in a video game studio right now, and you want to make your own game someday or have your own studio someday, but you haven't actually worked in a game studio, you don't necessarily know any programmers. A lot of a really good way, I think, to consider what other studios could be doing for you in this capacity is that the reality is if you get chances to, you know, ply your trade as an animator while also learning how a studio works. And also, of course, meeting people who are in the game dev space. In other words, if you worked for a studio in a capacity where you're able to deliver for them, while also, of course, learning tons of stuff, because if, you know, if you're working anywhere good, you'll be learning stuff the whole time. That can actually be a really good way to kind of actually,
I think that's
move
probably
forward.
The best way to get started if you're starting with, I've got some skills but I've never, you know, even considered running a business and that sort of thing, is to not start as an indie dev. I mean, you might join an indie dev team, but not start as the one who founded it, right? Mm-hmm. However, that of course assumes that you can get one of those jobs, which depends enormously on your situation, the place that you live, and the state of the world, you know, at the time that you're trying to do it.
Yes.
But it's a path worth exploring, and that you shouldn't look down on, because it's not the dream of like, I'm the person running the studio doing exactly what I want, because so much of this is learning about how to do stuff and starting to build networks of people who can help you in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, that's what we did. You know, Sam and I worked at another studio here in St. Louis for 8 months before we started Bscotch. So, and it was extremely valuable. We met a lot of people who were super talented, and we still rely on some of those people to this day to help us do things. One of them does our box art still, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we pay him to do it, but
backgrounds and level head for like the mm-hmm. right,
yeah,
all those,
yeah,
that was the same guy
made by a guy who we worked with at that first studio. And and you know, in some cases you'll go somewhere and you'll realize things that you don't want to do or things that you don't like about working on teams of certain mm-hmm. sizes or whatever.
Just but
that's
as valuable.
Also, that's also valuable. So it's really just, you just got to be doing stuff, get out there, get onto a team. If you're not looking to form one, publish things, just got to get that experience.
Yeah. But the first step is always clearly articulate a goal. Because once you have that, then now there's going to be a set of problems you're going to solve to get you there. And then you can get started down that path.
Back computing is way easier than trying to just like, make shit up, I think, you know, like as soon as
it is, yeah, because there's no answer to what should I do now if there's no end point that's intended, right. Yeah, because then the answer is just literally anything, because anything will get you somewhere, and then you have nowhere you're going. So as long as you're going somewhere,
we like to talk about the biased random walk approach, which is the way that bacteria get to their food source, right? Mm-hmm. But the important key word there is bias,
Yeah.
Right? Like they are
random is less important than bias. Yeah.
Yeah. They are just randomly moving around. They have a vague sense of whether or not they are closer or further away from their goal.
Yeah. Right? So on average, they get to the goal. Right. But they do it in a circuitous manner.
Yeah. They take a wildly inconsistent and roundabout path, but they get there. So that's okay.
That's right? I feel like that's everybody's story. Like I feel like whenever you hear when you sit down with a CEO talking or a product designer or else, like, so how did you get into this? And they always every person, even if they actually went into product design to start with, or whatever else, like that they ended up doing, I feel like every person always has like a genuinely sort of sporadically winding trail that ends up.
Well, you know why, Sam? Hmm. Because the universe is fractal.
Totally.
You know, we're made of bacteria and cells and stuff. And there's just no reason to think that we're going to behave any differently than the things that we're made of.
We'll just be rationalizing it the whole time. You know?
Yeah. Exactly. All right. Well, I think that's a good note to leave it on. That's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators to keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the past episodes. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Goodbye.